Hello, everyone. This is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Frank Joseph. He is the longtime editor-in-chief of Ancient American Magazine and a best-selling author of more than 20 books about prehistory and archaeology. Today, we're going to discuss his latest book, The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, which give us compelling evidence of ancient immigrants, lost technologies, and places of power. So welcome to the program, Frank.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Right. Now, you've written a book about some of my favorite subjects. I think ever since I started to read the work of Edgar Cayce with his references to Atlantis and Lemuria, I've always had a soft spot for them, and of course you can't help bringing in Egypt at the same time. Now, you've investigated the history of various areas in the world, but is there a lot of real evidence to prove the existence, say, of Atlantis?
I believe that if the case for Atlantis were put before a court of law, I could argue a guilty verdict on the circumstantial evidence. The physical evidence for Atlantis is equivocal at this point. And the reason for that is this is a civilization that has been lost for thousands of years, and you cannot expect the discovery of such a site to be in perfect condition. If what we're told by Plato and by Cayce, as you mentioned, is correct, and that the ruins of Atlantis lie beneath the sea, then they have had millennia of time for deposition to set in. Deposition is a constant rain of material. Most people aren't aware of this, but the interior of the oceans, the Atlantic Ocean as well, rains down material in the form of biological organisms that perish, mostly, also, algae and so forth when it decays. And so you have this constant rain of organic material that turns into silt. As a consequence, the ruins of Atlantis are not sitting very neatly on the bottom of the ocean. They're, in fact, buried not only under several miles of water, but also probably close to about a mile of silt and mud. And that's one reason why they have not yet been found. The technology, however, is evolving very quickly to the time where, I believe in this century, we will be able to detect the lost city of Atlantis that will be found with a higher technology than quite exists today. But to answer your question about physical evidence for Atlantis, there is quite a bit, a large body, a growing body, but it needs to be classified and studied in greater depth before we can say this is definitely an Atlantean artifact instead of being, say, a Trojan artifact or Phoenician.
Right. Now, do you believe, as Plato has said, that Atlantis existed in the Atlantic Ocean?
Yes, I do. I believe I have studied Plato's account and devoted the last almost 30 years of my life now primarily to examining the story of Atlantis. My other interests in contacts with North America from the outside world are actually an adjunct to that study. And I've traveled around the world myself specifically to gather what I feel are significant clues to the existence of Atlantis. I believe that Plato's account is fundamentally correct. It's interesting in my research and the research of my colleagues into the origin of Plato's account, we come to the conclusion that his dialogue in the Critias and in the Timaeus, these two dialogues that contain the Atlantis account, are actually summaries of a military report. They appear to be the work of a spy. We don't know who the spy was, but possibly a Greek spy who went to the city of Atlantis to make a military report and then came back, and this military report went through the hands of a very great and powerful Greek. His name was Solon. He was known as the Athenian lawgiver. He gave us the first modern bodies of law as we have it today. And in part of his work, he unearthed this military account of Atlantis. And if you look at Plato's account, it really, the emphasis is on the military aspects of this civilization. So, yes, I believe that Plato's account is absolutely correct. It's authentic. And I believe that a great body of supporting evidence bears that out. It's a very important discovery when Atlantis is made, because it probably was first the first real modern civilization as we have it, with cities and so forth. And it's a tremendously dramatic story.
Now, I gather from some checking out the Azores and other islands in the Atlantic, that they are actually the top of what appears to be a big mountain range. And it's been suggested that that may well have been part of Atlantis. Would you think that would be the case?
Yes and no. I believe that the Azores were definitely a part of the Atlantean Empire. It stands to reason they were not that far from it. But if you look at the bottom of the seafloor, if you look at the seafloor in the Atlantic Ocean, oceanographers have studied the seafloor in the Atlantic and have learned a lot about it. And we know that the seafloor in the Atlantic is spreading. It's called, as a matter of fact, seafloor spreading, where the continents of the Americas on one side and the European and African continents on the other are continuing to pull apart from each other at about an inch per year. And in doing that, as they pull apart from each other, they exert tremendous pressures on the floor of the Atlantic Ocean, and they spread it apart. They cause a seam or a rip in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And this causes a tremendous amount of seismic activity, volcanic activity. And in all that activity, that geologic violence that's going on the bottom of the ocean, whole mountains and mountain ranges rise and pierce the surface of the sea to become islands and mountain ranges. And over time, they collapse. Sometimes they collapse violently. Well, that fits in with the story of Atlantis. I believe that Atlantis, the real name of Atlantis is Greek, that we have. It's called Atlantikos, and in English we call it Atlantis. In German it's referred to as Atlantis, the same thing. In Latin languages it's referred to as Atlantida. The real name of Atlantis, according to Plato's study, if you look at it carefully, refers only to the city of Atlantis. And in Greek, Atlantikos means daughter of Atlas, or daughter of the mountain. There was a great mountain on the island of Atlantis, after which the entire country was named, and the city was named Atlantis. So I believe, in answer to your question, that Atlantis was not a continent. There are no continents. There's no evidence of any continents in the Atlantic Ocean. However, there is a great deal of evidence for sizable islands, large islands, perhaps as large as the modern country of Portugal, that have risen and fallen over the past millions of years. And I think that Atlantis was part of this geologic history of islands rising and falling, some of them quite large. You're right, the Azore Islands are part of a mountain range, and this mountain range may have extended contiguously to the island of Atlantis. That's possible. But the island of Atlantis itself was not a continent, but a large island, perhaps as large as Portugal.
Yes, mentioning the fact that there were islands rather than one continent, as I recall, seems to fit in with what I read in Edgar Cayce's readings. Now, I seem to recall also that one of the main islands was Poseidon. And am I correct in thinking that that name crops up a lot in sort of prehistory legends?
Yes, Poseidon is a very interesting name. Poseidon, of course, was the Greek god of the sea. It's not a Greek name. All the other Greek gods, Zeus and Hera and so forth, are part of the Greek language. Poseidon is not. And there's been a lot of debate over the origins of that name. In in Plato's account of Atlantis, he says that Poseidon, the sea god, was responsible for creating this island. And it seems to indicate that that name and that god originated in Atlantis, and there were either survivors of the Atlantean catastrophe or culture bearers from Atlantis that arrived in the Balkans and in Greece thousands of years ago, and that's part of their heritage, the mark that they made. When Casey talked about Poseidia, he appears to have referred not directly to Atlantis, but to a very important outpost of Atlantis. A careful reading of the Casey records that are contained in Volume 20 from the Association for Research and Enlightenment indicates that Poseidia, as described by Casey, refers to the Bahama Islands, specifically the small island today of Bimini, which is 55 miles off the coast of Miami, Florida. And that's very interesting because Casey says in several of his readings that the first remnants of the Atlantean culture would be found on the former Poseidia on the island of Bimini. And he said that this would be found; these remains would be found about 1968 or 1969. Well, he died in 1945. And sure enough, in 1969, a private pilot flying from Nassau in the Bahamas to Miami happened to look over the side of his aircraft, and he was able to see what he referred to as a wall sunken off the northern point of Bimini. And subsequent expeditions to this sighting that he made have indeed revealed a formation of beautifully cut large stones. They resemble large pillows, one on top of the other. It's been a very controversial site. People that are opposed to the very notion of Atlantis have dismissed it as just beach rock. They are incorrect. Anyone who goes to Bimini today, even as a tourist, an uneducated tourist, can see beach rock on the western side of Bimini, all over the place. And it does look like it's man-made rock from a distance. But when you come up close to the beach rock, you can see that it's just a natural formation caused by wave action. The beach rock on the western side of Bimini bears no resemblance whatsoever to the formation of stones on the northern end of Bimini, which are neatly placed. They resemble large pillows, as I said, not beach rock, and some are stacked upon one atop the other. That does not occur in beach rock. So this is definitely a man-made formation. Its depth is 19 feet below the water, the surface of the water, which would indicate that this structure was dry land about 3,000, at least 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. At that time, the sea levels were much lower, and someone could have built the wall or dock or whatever it's referred to. We're not sure exactly what it is. It does resemble a Bronze Age harbor. During the Bronze Age, harbors were made in the shape of either an elongated oval or a kind of a J. That's exactly what you see at the northern end of Bimini. It's either a J or originally an oval shape. So there's been a lot of research done there that has proven over and over again that this is a man-made structure dating to the latter period of Atlantis. Whether it's actually Atlantean or not, we don't know, but Casey said it was, and he hit the nail on the head when it came to the time that it was found. It makes sense that it would be an Atlantean site, because Bimini is the last stop that you can make for fresh water if you are leaving the Americas, the last stop before you return to Europe. And the Americas were a very valuable place for people in the ancient world, because primarily of our copper. The upper peninsula of the Great Lakes around Michigan has the largest concentration of high-grade copper on Earth, and someone found these large deposits a very long time ago. In the upper peninsula of Michigan and parts of Wisconsin along the shores of Lake Superior are a minimum of 5,000 pit mines. And these pit mines go directly into these very rich, valuable veins of copper. And they were worked and excavated beginning about 3000 B.C. The copper removed from these mines is mind-boggling. A conservative estimate puts the amount of copper removed in the ancient world at a quarter of a billion pounds. And it's probably a great larger amount than that. This copper that was removed has vanished. There's no trace of it in the Americas. But at the same time that this copper was being removed, the Bronze Age erupted in Europe and in the Near East. And in order to make bronze, you have to have high-grade copper. Europe and the Near East have never had large concentrations of copper. There have been copper in Cyprus. Matter of fact, the island of Cyprus, it comes from the word Kippur, the Assyrian word Kippur for copper. But the copper is of a relatively low grade and not as plentiful as here in the Americas. So we believe, putting two and two together, that the island of Bimini served as a last stop for freighters, Atlantean freighters, and probably from other nations, other cultures, that took the copper from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, freighted it down the east coast of the Americas, of North America, to Bimini, took on fresh supplies, water there, and then made it back, made the return voyage to Western Europe and to the Near East.
Now, that's a very interesting story. And was it off the Bimini Wall that when the pilot who saw the Bimini Wall also saw a pyramid, or was that someone else?
The stories of a pyramid around Bimini have come up from time to time, but unfortunately there has been no actual documented sighting. I'm taking most of my information about Bimini from a very brilliant man. His name is William Donato. He's been on international television several times. He is the president of the Atlantis Organization in California, and he has devoted his life, the last 30 years or so, to examining the story of Atlantis. It's his, the main focus of his life, and he's the leading expert on Bimini in the Bahamas. He has told me about supposed sightings from time to time of a pyramidal structure. I wouldn't discount it, but unfortunately it hasn't been photographed. It hasn't been relocated. We don't know exactly where it is. I've had several dives with Mr. Donato at Bimini over the years, and I have seen some remarkable things, and it's entirely possible that a pyramid exists down there. We had a dive, I think one of the most outstanding dives of my life. I've had hundreds of scuba dives, naturally being interested in Atlantis, right?
Yes, yeah.
But one of the most interesting scuba dives I had in my life was about 7 miles away from Bimini, a place called Moselle Shoals, and there we found these enormous pillars, obviously man-made, again, about 19 feet below the surface. And when you first dive down, all you see is just white sand, that's all, and some very large manta rays, by the way, but just white sand, just a desert. And then you come to this little, like a little rise, a little hill, and it's covered with these immense pillars, and they're like no pillars that you've seen, really. They kind of resemble, they're kind of square, elongated squares, and they taper to one end. They're obviously not natural formations, and it looks like you're looking at a temple that has either fallen over or pieces of it were delivered. It's very strange, but to see this collection of pillars 7 miles out in the middle of the ocean, the middle of nowhere, all on this little hill. So I wouldn't put it past the possibility of finding a pyramid down there after having seen that.
Hmm. I seem to remember, with regards to this pyramid sighting, that it had been seen on more than one occasion by pilots flying over that part of the sea. And they said that when the lights seemed to strike the sea in a certain way, it sort of seemed to open up the view of the pyramid. But I also read in subsequent years that someone did actually locate it and dive down and found a crystal inside the pyramid, which they removed. I mean, you may be aware of that story and discount it as having any reliability, but I thought I would mention that.
Well, I'm glad you did. It was a dentist by the name of Dr. Brown. He was in Miami, and this is about, let's say, 40-some years ago now, and we were able to examine the crystal that he allegedly brought up, and we're not entirely convinced that that story is as reliable as we would like it to be, unfortunately. That's all I can say about that.
Well, I'm glad you had heard of it and made your own inquiries. Now, you're talking about columns laying on the seabed.
Yeah.
I also recall the story quite some years ago of when they were laying cables in the Atlantic Ocean at a very big depth, and laying on the ocean floor were columns and maybe other items like it. Is that also a reference that you know of?
Yes, and that is a correct reference. There have been more than one instance, Michael, where people have been, oceanographers or people laying cables and so forth, have not been looking for artifacts or archaeological remains at all and have come up with a surprising amount of material. These materials have either been lost or discounted by archaeologists who took no interest in them, which is a real tragedy. I would say one of the most remarkable of all was in the late 1880s when an American schooner was traveling from London to New York. And about a third of the way, I guess past the Azore Islands, there was a major sea quake going on. This is for a fact. Now, this is known for a fact. There was a major sea quake. A lot of fish die off and so on. It was recorded. And during this sea quake, there was something of a small wave, a small tsunami, nothing bad at all, maybe about 2 feet high. And there was also some volcanic activity, which is things like this have been recorded. Of course, smoke and fire coming out of the sea as a little volcano rises. Well, in this particular instance, this is about 1883, the captain of the ship saw a small island rise out of the sea. These things do happen in the Atlantic Ocean. An example of that in modern times is the island of Surtsey, which was recorded in the early 1960s. It's a small island. It grew to the size of about 3.5 miles, and then overnight it collapsed back into the sea. So these things do happen. Well, in 1883, this captain steered to the island to investigate it, and found that it was covered with artifacts of various kinds, swords, spears, staircases, things like that. And some of the items were brought back to aboard ship. Not many, very, very few, maybe half a dozen or so. And then the island slowly collapsed back into the sea with the rest of its stairways and walls and so forth. It actually had some sailors on board who investigated this place. When the ship arrived, I told you it was in New York. I'm sorry, it was in Boston. It returned to Boston. When the ship arrived in Boston Harbor, the items were actually put on public display by the captain. We have newspaper reports of this exhibition that he put on. There wasn't any charge or any money involved in that at all. So this really happened. What became of those artifacts, I have no idea. But we did trace that this was a real account. It does not appear to be a hoax or anything like that. It was in the United States newspapers. So there are occasions, just exactly as you say, in which occasionally artifacts and sightings of metropolitan areas that are divulged from the sea do take place, do happen.
Yes. It's a pity in that case mentioning these artifacts that were found on that island, that they've disappeared. I suppose they've ended up in some museum somewhere, probably in the cellar, because people can't identify them to any particular time in our history, which often happens if artifacts are around that don't fit in with the recognized view, I believe.
Yes, that happens too often, unfortunately. As I recall, though, I don't have the notes for that information in front of me. I believe that the captain had the artifacts in his possession, some of them in his possession, for some years, and that he divvied up the artifacts with the crew members that went to the trouble of removing him from the island. I think he shared some of that with his crew. So there were not many artifacts, and he kept, I think, three or so. And they were around for some time after his death, I think into the 1930s, when they finally just disappeared. They were examined, I do know, by what was known in those days as antiquarians. An antiquarian was a kind of a proto-archaeologist. And the archaeologists or the antiquarians of that time, 1883, said that these were legitimate Bronze Age artifacts. They couldn't identify the culture involved, but they said that they felt that they were from the late Bronze Age. And that fits the tail end of Atlantis. I know we've strayed kind of far from what we were originally talking about, but it's an interesting subject. And if any of our listeners are interested in this, I do have a book that I've written about this to a large degree, things we've been talking about, and that's called Survivors of Atlantis. I spent a lot of time working on that. I've traveled far. And that book is available at Amazon.com, Survivors. Another good one on that is, well, I hope it's good, is the Atlantis Encyclopedia. That really took a long time to put together, as you might figure. And both of those are available at Amazon.com.
Mm. Well, having done all that, it's not surprising you are full of good information and facts about Atlantis.
It's just very interesting. It's kind of an obsession, you know, and I love sharing it with persons like yourself. And it's kind of the focus of my life, yeah.
Oh, yes, I think it's very fascinating indeed. I was going to say, make a final comment about artifacts to do with Atlantis. I also read somewhere that I think it was in Greece that they found, I think it was a vase or something like that, which was a gift from King Kronos, who they identified as a king of Atlantis. Is that another story you can comment on?
I know exactly what you're talking about. It refers to a man by the name of Paul Schliemann. And he was either a nephew or a great-grandson, I think more like a grand-nephew of Heinrich Schliemann. Heinrich Schliemann, of course, was a very famous discoverer of the ruins of Troy. And Paul Schliemann was, I guess, a kind of an amateur archaeologist. We don't know much about him. We tried for years to learn more about Paul Schliemann. We did find out that he did really exist. Some skeptics said that this was just a name that someone made up. Mm-hmm. In any case, Paul Schliemann received from either his, he was his nephew, so it would be his granduncle, a vase that Heinrich Schliemann found in the ruins of Ilios. Ilios was the capital of Troy. And in this vase, Heinrich Schliemann was able to extract a small tablet, I believe, and this tablet, or the inscription, referred to the vase as a gift from King Kronos of Atlantis. That's actually all that fits quite well, believe it or not. The connection between Troy and Atlantis is very strong, and it begins in myth. The story of Troy is that it was founded by a figure whose name was Dardanus. And Dardanus is described in Greek myth as having been born on this island in the middle of the sea, far away. And the description of this island makes it clear that it was Atlantis, because his mother, the mother of Dardanus, was Electra. And Electra was one of the Pleiades. This is getting rather complex. I should try to simplify it as much as I can. Electra being one of the Pleiades is interesting because the Pleiades were Atlantises. They were the daughters of the goddess Pleione and the god Atlas. So if you are a daughter of Atlas, you are an Atlantis. So in effect, this myth of Dardanus is saying that his mother was an Atlantis. He's from Atlantis. The story of Electra is that she sank into the sea, very Atlantean story, and that he traveled to the Dardanelles. The name the Dardanelles today in Turkey takes its name after Dardanus, the mythological figure that I'm describing. So Troy would appear to be has a very Atlantean origin. Paul Schliemann himself died in World War I, we found out. He was a soldier, he was a junior officer who was killed on the Western Front about 1915 or 1916. And that's why it makes it difficult to really find out more about his story. The story that he told about King Kronos and Atlantis was featured in major newspapers around the world just before the outbreak of the war, about 1912 or 14, 1913, something like that. That's kind of unfortunate that he passed away in that regard, because we don't know much more about that story.
Right, well, that's interesting again.
It's credible. I would not dismiss his story. I really wouldn't. It's one of those that you can't absolutely verify, but I think it's credible and should not be dismissed.
Right, now, how do you think the final destruction of Atlantis took place, or what was the cause?
This is one of the things that is best known about Atlantis. And although it's a controversial story, not everyone that is involved in studying Atlantis agrees with this, a growing body of evidence is convincing more serious scholars and my closest colleagues that this is what actually happened. People ask me often, how old was Atlantis? I don't know. I know it was a very old society. It began many thousands of years ago. It was a very primitive establishment at first, and over time rose to greater levels of sophistication, incredible levels of cultural magnificence, an imperial power, a world power, the first true world power built on sea power. It was very similar to, say, the British Empire at its height, where you had a relatively small island that had immense power built on its navy. And at the height of its power, it lasted, I feel, way into the Bronze Age, into the late Bronze Age. We're talking here about 1200 BC, about 3,200 years ago. Now, the destruction of Atlantis, no matter who you read about Atlantis, it usually involves some kind of geologic violence. Plato himself says that the island of Atlantis, after a series of geologic upheavals, sank into the sea. Now, Plato's account is not complete. Just as he's about to describe the destruction of Atlantis, the narrative breaks off. We don't have that. However, he does give us some hints about what that destruction was supposed to be. For example, he has Zeus, the king of the gods and the sky god, ordering its destruction. So it would appear that he is talking about something coming from the sky. Plato also makes a parallel between Atlantis and the Greek myth of Phaethon. Phaethon was this youth who stole the chariot of Apollo, the sun god, lost control of the chariot, and crashed to earth. And that Plato himself says that this myth is a parallel of meteoric activities when an asteroid or a meteor or a comet comes too close to the earth and causes destruction. This is what Plato himself says. So linking up these myths to the possibilities of how Atlantis was really destroyed, a very valuable, matter of fact, decisive conference took place in 1997. And it took place in England. It was a meeting of world-class scientists from around the world. And it was to determine one question. And that question was, what caused the end of the Bronze Age? The Bronze Age, we know, was a period of great cultural splendor and wealth. Egypt was at its height. Mycenaean Greece was strong. Troy, before the war, center of great cultural magnificence. The Etruscans were on their way up. And then all of a sudden, the Bronze Age just ended. It just quit. No one's been able to explain what happened. We could understand how one of these civilizations would collapse, but to have all of them virtually implode at the same time, there was also a tremendous evidence of burning that took place around the Northern Hemisphere at this time. So this conference that took place in England in 1997 was to ask the these world-class scientists, what in their opinion could have caused the end of the Bronze Age. And these scientists included dendrochronologists. These are scientists who are able to make dating according to tree rings, for example. Tree ring growth is affected by if there's too much water or not enough, and they can understand what causes that. All kinds of geophysicists, oceanographers from Japan, the United States, all over the British Isles, Western Europe. And they came to this wonderful conclusion, which is available today at Amazon.com. It's called The End of the Bronze Age. It's a very long, large, very scientific, scholarly tome, which includes literally dozens of essays from these scholars who in 1997 concluded that a major comet made a very close pass to the Earth, that the name of this comet is Encke, E-N-C-K-E. It's named after Wilhelm Encke, who was a Swiss astronomer in the 18th century who first discovered this comet. And this comet, according to archaeoastronomers who had at their disposal some of the world-class state-of-the-art computers to fit it in with telescopes to see what the configuration of the heavens were like 3,000 years ago, they say that around the year 1198 BC, this comet made a very close pass to the Earth. And in doing so, it rained down a barrage of material, of meteoritic and asteroid material, that crashed into the northern hemisphere. One of the things that they were able to establish is that the entire Black Forest of Germany at this time was incinerated, that the British Isles were virtually depopulated, not only of human life, but of all life, that all of the cities across the Peloponnesus in Greece were incinerated simultaneously. They then compared this physical evidence with the chronologies of the time from China and from Egypt. And these chronologies speak of fire from heaven. They speak of great amounts of ash fall and darkness at noon. So we believe that the close passage of this comet, which pushed so many civilizations over the brink of destruction, did in fact do that. It annihilated the island of Atlantis. And we believe that the culprit, the direct culprit, was an asteroid that either split in two or two asteroids traveling in tandem that crashed into the eastern Atlantic. We know this is a fact. There are two brilliant Swedish geophysicists, Lars and Franson, who were able to show that this asteroid crashed into the eastern Atlantic around 1198 BC. This would indicate the final destruction of Atlantis. The asteroids, when they crashed into the seabed, they disrupted the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, this highly stable, unstable seismic rift, and that this led from one catastrophe to another. It undermined the geological pins, as it were, of Atlantis, and it collapsed into the sea. That's how we believe it happened.
Well, that's very interesting. Again, I know there are many theories and ideas about the cause of Atlantis going down. Some comments you made just struck a chord with me when you mentioned a little earlier about the sun gods ordering the destruction of, was it Atlantis? And I remember that when I read about the Sumerian period, it would appear that they also ordered the destruction or the flooding of, mm-hmm. of that area. Mm-hmm. And you're also talking about a comet called Enki, and one of the Anunnaki gods was Enki and his brother Enlil. So it's funny, in a weird way, you could almost find a connection with those type of incidents.
It is kind of strange. The comet Encke, though, is named after, like I said, this Swiss astronomer. And I know we hear, of course, about Encke and Enkidu, the mythological figures that are known to us from the Sumerian tradition. The Sumerians also talked about this great event that took place. It's enshrined in the traditions of numerous peoples throughout the Northern Hemisphere. It is a theory, but it is a theory that is backed up by a tremendous amount of evidence, both cultural and material. So I believe that this was the final destruction of Atlantis that took place. This is the way it happened, because it's not an anomaly. It's within the context of what we know happened throughout the Northern Hemisphere. The Americas were affected also in a terrible way. We know, for example, the Cascade Range of North America, all of its volcanoes, like Mount St. Helens, exploded simultaneously. And this could have only happened through the disruption of a major meteoritic barrage that took place. Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing, Mike. Well, not funny at all, but humanity has been pushed to the brink of extinction several times. We think of ourselves as having slowly evolved peacefully over hundreds of thousands or millions of years to where we are now, but that's not the case. There have been episodes in the history of our species and other species where we have come very close, right to the razor's edge of winking out. And that was only one time where we almost bought it completely, and we would have been replaced by something else.
Mm. Now, referring again to evidence of Atlantis, is there any indication of where the Atlanteans might have gone to, that is, those who left before it sunk?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question, please?
Yes. Is there any evidence of where the Atlanteans went to avoid going down with
it when
it sunk?
Oh, where the Atlanteans themselves went to?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Well, I think what happened with them was that they were able to go to various parts of the world. Don't forget that they were great seafarers, great mariners, and we see a tremendous impact that they made, I think, on both east and west. I hardly know where to begin, as a matter of fact. When you, for example, in England itself, in Britain, we have Stonehenge. And comparing Stonehenge to the Atlantean phenomena is remarkable. Stonehenge is made up of these concentric, a rather unusual arrangement of concentric rings, and that has, of course, all these astronomical qualities to it. Well, that's the basic configuration. That's like the cultural fingerprint of the Atlanteans themselves, because they enjoyed, apparently, building things in concentric designs. Also, the building, the phases of Stonehenge parallel the episodes of Atlantis itself. The earliest known building of Stonehenge, the so-called Aubrey holes that go around the exterior, date back to about 3000 or 3100 BC. Well, that's an extremely important period in Atlantean history, because that represents the first migration of Atlanteans. The first major migration of Atlanteans appears to have taken place around 3000 BC. Then we have completion, or the almost total completion of Stonehenge around 1500 BC. That's another extremely important event horizon in the story of Atlantis, because 1500 BC represents another period of major immigration from Atlantis. There was some geologic trouble taking place, nothing as bad as what happened later on, but nonetheless, we can trace migrations that took place from Atlantis around 1500 BC. 1500 BC, we see the flourishing of Stonehenge, a major change. And then in 1200 BC, Stonehenge is suddenly abandoned. It's not used anymore. 1200 BC, that's the destruction of Atlantis. That's a period of time that was caused by planet by a rather comet Encke that caused all of this ash fall that changed our climate forever after. And so something even as close as Stonehenge, and I'm just giving the thumbnail sketches here. In my books, I've tried to link up greater details, but just the general resemblance between the phases of Stonehenge, the physical resemblance of Stonehenge to Atlantis, can't be denied. Otherwise, we look at places like Stonehenge isolated, and we can't figure out, well, why did these changes take place and what was responsible for them? We assume it was just the local people, but we don't really know. It's very interesting, and it explains a lot. Atlantis is like a great explanation. It makes a lot of these mysteries clear. It clarifies these enigmas that have puzzled scholars for hundreds of years.
So everything is very fascinating about our ancient history. Now, in your book, you also refer to lost technologies. Would you like to say a little bit about that?
Right. The Atlanteans, of course, were described as being not only culturally magnificent and materially very wealthy, but also in possession of a very advanced technology. And sometimes the technology refers to all kinds of high levels of achievement that challenge our own ability to make and do things. And in my latest book, it's called The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, we have a chapter in there about one of the greatest mysteries of the ancient world that is not well known really outside of Costa Rica, and that's where these mysteries are found mostly. In Costa Rica, in 1940, were found the first of these large stone spheres. There was a plantation that was being cleared by a United States firm, and in clearing the jungle, the workers came across what looked like the top of a large ball sticking out of the bottom of the earth. This is an area of Costa Rica that had never been worked before, had never been settled before, and no one was known to have ever lived there. So they dug out what they thought was this ball, and it turns out to be a sphere, which was almost 7 feet in diameter, a perfect stone sphere made out of a form of granite. And the precision, the workmanship that went into this stone sphere is remarkable. It is a perfect circle within 0.005 inches. I don't know how that translates into centimeters, but it's almost a perfect sphere. Now, can you imagine taking a rough piece of granite to a quarry or a stonemaker and saying, I want a perfect stone sphere almost 7 feet across, and I want it within 0.005 inches of perfection? I mean, they would say, well, maybe we can do it and maybe we can't. How old these things are, it's impossible to determine. I say these because up to now, about 300 of these stone spheres have been found. Some of them are as small as a basketball, maybe a foot across. And then the largest is the one that I've described, which is not quite 7 feet across, weighs over 300. It weighs about 7 tons, as I recall. No one knows who made these spheres. Although the area was occupied by the Maya, there is no indication that they made them because these stone spheres don't occur in any other Mayan city or area. The stone spheres also are found on some of the islands off the coast of Costa Rica. Now, what that would mean is that you would need more than a birch bark canoe or a raft to take a 7 or 6 ton stone sphere across the ocean, 9 miles across the ocean, to put it onto an island. That indicates that there was some real seafaring going on in ancient Costa Rica. Some of these stone spheres have been found in Haiti, at least one that I know of, and some have been found in, believe it or not, Troy, on the other side of the world. I visited the Museum of Çanakkale in Ilios in Turkey, and there were a number of stone spheres, not as large as the ones found in Costa Rica, maybe about 3 to 4, not quite 4 feet in diameter. No one knows who made them or why. Some of these stones have been broken in half. People have wanted to know what's inside. They've drilled dynamite inside and blew them up, thinking they might be hollow or contain something. No, they're solid granite all the way through. Some of the stone spheres have been found arranged in bizarre formations. Bizarre meaning like chevrons or triangles. If they're pointing at something, nobody knows what they're indicating. Now, who made these? How long ago were they made? Do not know. But the thing that can be deduced from them is that they are very old, because if they were not buried, that means that they were buried deliberately by human beings. They were buried by deposition. In other words, things fell on them, and eventually they got buried underground. If that's the case, they're many thousands of years old, many thousands, millennia old. The other thing we can deduce is that whoever built these things was in possession of an incredibly advanced technology that rivals our own. Who could have done such a thing, and why? It does point to Atlantis, because we do know that the Atlanteans were very interested in the Americas, that perhaps they used these stones not as guides or something like that. There's no way you could use them as astronomical markers, as some people have suggested. So that's an example of ancient technology which certainly challenges our own.
Yes, I have seen photographs of those spheres, and well, as you described on the one that was 7 feet in diameter, they are, generally speaking, quite enormous. In your travels, I'm sure you must have come across some of the stories about caves being discovered with light in them, a source of light that someone checked out and found it was cold light, and they couldn't understand how it was evidently on the whole time. Now, have you any thoughts about that?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we have a chapter about that in The Lost Worlds of Ancient America.
Oh, right.
There is a very brilliant electronics engineer, his name is Larry Brian Radka, and he has contributed a chapter to The Lost Worlds of Ancient America about the use of an application of electrical energy in prehistoric times. And he refers directly to this cave that you are mentioning that was found in Brazil, in Mato Grosso, Brazil, in the 1920s. This cave contained a sphere that continuously emitted a kind of a cold light. It's been compared to the light that comes from fireflies. It's brilliant, but it has no heat. That this stone sphere was known to the local native people, the Amazonian people that live in the area. They knew it for a long time. What became of this sphere, I have no idea, but it is well attested, especially by a very brilliant author. His name was Harold Wilkins, who also visited this sphere and saw it in Brazil. This is not the only instance of these caves that are illuminated. In Arizona, in the American Southwest, there are a number of these phosphates that have been found that emit a kind of a cold light. And these phosphates were used by people known in the Americas as the Anasazi, who used these cold phosphates in a way to illuminate caves and in other areas. So it's possible that the ancient Egyptians, were also in possession of a similar technology. The reason why we say that is because many of their subterranean corridors and their temples are beautifully illuminated, completely covered with detailed hieroglyphs, and yet there is no indication that any torches were ever used. There's no burn marks ever found on the ceilings. There's no indication that anything has been scrubbed off, as it were. And so that's a mystery, is how did the ancient Egyptians illuminate some of their very dark recesses, especially their tombs, the deep tombs that are there, when there's no indication in any of them that torches were ever used. So it's possible that they were also in possession of this cold light technology. It's another example of how the ancients had a very close observation of nature. closer than ours, and that they applied nature. Our society is rather artificial. It's based on kind of a technology that is not as related closely to nature as the ancients. And I think that that's what, where they derived their great technological breakthroughs, was through a close scrutiny of natural law and then the application of that natural law to society.
Oh, again, a very interesting explanation there. Now, in your own experience, even if you have not found much, if any, evidence, can you go back to any civilization that is older than Lemurian and Atlantean?
Lemuria appears to be the very first place where human beings made the step from savagery to civilization. I say that because earlier I mentioned how human beings came very close to extinction on a number of times. And recently it was discovered, recently meaning in only, I think, the last 15 or 18 years, was found that 75,000 years ago, there was a volcanic eruption in Indonesia, and it was referred to as Mount Toba today. It is the largest known volcanic eruption that the Earth has ever experienced. The volcanic eruption was so serious, it ejected so much ash material into the atmosphere that it created a die-off of a number of species that vanished, including our own, almost. That before Mount Toba erupted 75,000 years ago, we are told, the human species had about 2 million persons. That was our population worldwide, about 2 million. This figure comes from DNA, which is able to miraculously help us to deduce the populations, previous population structures of our species. And according to DNA computer studies, about 80,000, 75,000 years ago, there were about 2 million of us. But after Mount Toba erupted 75,000 years ago, the human species, we are told, was reduced to about 2,000 breeding pairs, from 2 million to 2,000. So we were right on the razor's edge of extinction, and we came back from that very slowly and gradually. And that being in Indonesia, that relates directly to the very gradual early formation of Lemuria. So I do not believe, so far as I know, I think that Lemuria represents the very first time that human beings, having come back from this terrific near-extinction event, slowly gathered themselves together and created the first really sophisticated culture. That event, as terrible as it was in terms of killing off most of our species, also was the most beneficial thing that has ever happened to us, because the only people, the only individuals who survived Mount Toba were the toughest, the most healthy, the most intelligent, the most adaptive. And because they survived, they gave us, through their genetic heritage, our genetic heritage from them, the immunity systems that we all possess today as a species. We are healthier, stronger, and more adaptive because of that great catastrophe that happened. And I think in the process, you either had to adapt to an entirely different world, a changed over world, or else you died. And most of us did die, the vast majority of us. Of us did die, perish. But the strongest, the best survived, and through the blood that really has flowed from them to us, we owe to their survival. And I think it's in that process, that great challenge they went through, that they spread across the islands of the Central and Western Pacific, and that is the origin of Lemuria. Lemuria was not a continent either, although there's some real debate on that. There is evidence for a possible continent in the Pacific that is still being debated. But more importantly than that, Lemuria should be regarded as a culture that has spread over island archipelagos. In other words, strings or series of islands across the Central Pacific. And I think that that's what Lemuria should really be viewed as. I don't see, in answer to your question, any high culture before then, because it does not appear that we as a species had what it took intellectually to pull together a sophisticated culture. But I think Lemuria, very slowly over time, that we did coalesce it. And Lemuria is the Garden of Eden. In effect, it is the birthplace of civilized man. I truly believe that. I've written a book on that that I feel very confident about. It's called The Lost Civilization of Lemuria. It's a rather large book. I spent a great deal of time on that. I traveled quite far. I went through the Pacific and Polynesia, and I went to Japan and Thailand, and I met some wonderful people and great scholars that helped me. And I feel very confident that the birthplace of civilized man, and maybe the birthplace of modern man himself, that's very possible, was in Indonesia and in the Pacific. It was a rather fluid condition. In the very early time, we mastered seafaring. I think that archaeologists do our species a great injustice by saying that we were afraid of the sea. I think that we took to the sea very early on, and that we crossed great stretches of it, and that that helped us to evolve also. I don't see, so, you know, but it's an interesting thing, Michael, because there have been artifacts. This is really, it throws all this into a cocked hat. There have been artifacts found under very peculiar situations and conditions that go back millions of years. Millions of years. We're talking about like hammers and footprints and various things that go back many millions of years ago. And there is no very easy explanation for all of them. If only one or two were found, that would be, you know, just an anomaly of some kind. But there are more than one or two. There are dozens or maybe hundreds of strange artifacts, pots and metalwork and so forth, that are found in rock that are millions of years old. How do we explain these things? Not easily. So it's possible that human beings have evolved and disappeared numerous times, that maybe we are not the only human species to have evolved. Maybe we're not the only civilization. Maybe Lemuria was not the first. Maybe there were many before, over millions of years, and that they just utterly vanished, and little traces of them still exist. That's totally that's not totally theoretical. We do have physical evidence. But who these cultures were, who they might have been, we don't know. Very interesting. Very interesting.
Wouldn't we just love to have a crystal ball that we could look into and find out all of the answers? One of the artifacts that has always stuck in my mind that was found, I think, deep in a coal mine was this machined, almost cube-shaped piece of metal. And obviously that must come from some advanced people or technology.
Yeah.
You no doubt are familiar with what I'm talking about.
Yes, I am, yeah. I know. I have no idea what to make of that. It's truly astounding. And, of course, there are human footprints, no doubt, human footprints that are fossilized, that are found in the same stream beds with dinosaurs. And these footprints are found in various parts of North America. And when they were first found, skeptics says, oh, they're hoaxes. They must be a hoax. Until, shortly thereafter, the same type of stream bed where human footprints were, along with dinosaur footprints, was found in Siberia. What are we to make of this? Does this mean that human beings were living with dinosaurs more than 65 million years ago? Or does it mean that dinosaurs somehow moved into our time? It would appear not. It would appear that those human footprints actually belong to more than 65 million years ago, because the stratigraphy involved in removing some of those footprints of the human beings and the dinosaurs together go back about 70 or 80 million years ago. I don't know what to make of that. It completely dynamites all theories.
As though the human beings must have kept dinosaurs as pets in the same way that we keep dogs.
Or the other way around. We were friends.
Now, you mentioned that you've done scuba diving, and I know from what I've read about your adventures that you have been on many underwater archaeological expeditions in the Bahamas, Yucatan, Canary Islands, Aegean, and Polynesia, if that's not enough. Now, what I'd like to ask you about is you must obviously be aware of the remains of what appears to be a quayside of some type off the island of Yoganuni. I think I've got the name right. Well, what would you like to say about that?
That's a remarkable discovery. Yonaguni is this little almond-shaped island. It is the last in the chain of the Japanese islands, they're referred to as the Ryukyus, that stream off the southern end of mainland Japan towards Korea. And Yonaguni is the last of this series of islands. And in 1986, a scuba diver who ran a scuba diving shop was looking for a new area to take his clients to go diving. And so he tried out this area of Yonaguni, and the waters are very clear there. You have over 100 feet visibility, very beautiful. And he found what appears to be a man-made structure about 100 feet below the water, that the base is 100 feet below the water, the surface of the water. And it doesn't resemble a quayside so much, or a harbor, so much as it looks kind of like a mound of a stone that's been carved with steps and staircases and unusual sculpture, very bizarre. One that looks like a kind of arena of some kind, another one that looks like a pylon. And so he didn't know what to make of this, and he reported it to Professor Masakai Kimura at the University of the Ryukyus. Professor Masakai Kimura is a world-class geologist, has a world-class reputation. He knew nothing about this structure at all, of course, and so he investigated it, found it was interesting. It looked very artificial, but he knows that nature can sometimes make things that look like they're man-made, but they're not. And so for 3 years, Professor Kimura and his class investigated this structure in the waters off Yonaguni. And he issued a report, which I have, and I've commented on and reproduced to some extent in The Lost Civilization of Lemuria, in which he says that there's no doubt that this structure is man-made, that he even found tool marks on the structure itself, plus he found the tools that made these marks. And he believes that it was he refers to it as a citadel. That is just a name that's applied to it. We don't know that's what it was, but it really is a kind of a temple structure. It is a sacred structure. It is a natural formation of rock that has been terraformed, that has been changed deliberately by human hands, perhaps as long ago as 10,000 years ago. The reason why we think 10,000 years ago, that's an incredibly long time, is because the sea levels at that time were not low enough to afford people to go onto this rock to change it. Now, since Professor Kimura has made his report, there have been about a dozen geologists from around the world that have examined this feature. And of those dozen, I think only two believe that it's a natural formation, that 10 conclude that it is definitely man-made, including Professor Kimura. Professor Schock from Boston University is not sure that it is man-made. It might be terraformed. He's not entirely convinced. And then there's a German professor who is sure that it's definitely natural. But the other 10 are quite convinced that only human beings could have terraformed this rock to resemble a kind of a sacred structure. There's a large representation of what appears to be a turtle on this structure. It's not the only one that's found in the Okinawa. Around Okinawa have been found also similar structures, not as large. And another island called Fukushima, off the east, the western coast of Japan, has a staircase that photographs of it indicate definitely a man-made structure. Another Japanese island called Okinoshima which is in the Sea of Korea, has a flight of steps that have been photographed, have been verified as obviously man-made. Nature is not going to make a flight of steps, staircases. So it's I think Japan, the waters of Japan are rich with these archaeological finds, and Yonaguni, I think, is part of the Lemurian culture. Now, as far as the dating of this, it could be 10,000 years old, which is remarkable because human beings weren't supposed to be making things like this after the end of the Ice Age. Professor Kimura thinks that it's not quite that old, that it goes back to about 3,000 years ago, which is also pretty good. 3,000 years ago would be right about the final days of Lemuria. Lemuria suffered a natural catastrophe also by this same comet that I mentioned. This comet, according to the geophysicists who met in England in 1997, is a periodic comet. It appears every November. We still see it in the skies. But as you know, when comets go around the sun, they always lose something of their mass, their density. And so Comet Encke today is just a pale ghost of what it once was because it's gone around the sun so many times, it hardly is there anymore. But if you do a computer simulation and you backlog what this comet looked like in the ancient past, it was a ferocious thing to see in the sky. It was incredibly bright, far brighter than Halley's Comet. It was a dangerous-looking phenomenon. And it made four close passes to the Earth, and each time it made a close pass, it rained down meteoritic material. And this one time it made a close pass around 1628, according to the scientists. And in 1628, that parallels the final destruction of Lemuria. And Lemuria was destroyed differently than Atlantis. Lemuria was the victim of the same sort of catastrophe that has afflicted Japan a year ago. And we're talking about a tsunami. The asteroids and the meteorites that Comet Encke shot into the Pacific Ocean created enormous walls of water that make the Japan tsunami of 2011 appear as a minor incident by comparison. We know that some of the waves that traveled across the ocean at that time were far over 100 feet high. We know that because material that they dredged up from the bottom of the ocean has been deposited on the mountains of Hawaii, dated to that time at about 100 feet up, more than 100 feet. So that Lemuria was, and its people, its culture, were scourged by a series of 100-foot-high tsunamis that crashed over the islands in 1628 B.C. And that's how that society was literally wiped out. But Yonaguni would appear to have been very much a Lemurian site. As a matter of fact, even Professor Kimura, as a mainstream archaeologist, is to be congratulated because not only for his telling us and showing us how Yonaguni is a man-made site, but also because he says it was connected with Lemuria. In Japan, they refer to this civilization as Mu. It's sometimes also referred to under various other names. It's an old, Lemuria was very, very old. It began about 75,000 years ago and slowly evolved over time, so naturally it's going to have different names over time. Lemuria is one of its names. Mu is another. So it's understandable.
It sounds as though if you have the time or the interest in it, as you obviously have, you can find a lot of evidence for these older civilizations. I mean, you're obviously very well or very knowledgeable about them. Now, coming back to your scuba diving again, what, in your opinion, was the most exciting evidence you found at anywhere that you went?
Well, I would have to go back to what I told you before when we, my friend William Donato, who's this great expert on the Bahamas and Bimini especially, he took me out to Moselle Shoals, which is a shallow area about 19 feet below the surface, about 7 miles due north of the island of Bimini, and it was there that we found, like I say, this little island that was covered with these great pillars. That's a sight that I just will never forget. I think that was, it's absolutely convincing what happens. I mean, it looks like a temple that one of two things happened. It was either a temple that was erected one time and some geologic violence tossed it over and sank it into the sea, or else that these were parts of a temple that were being transported and the ship that was transporting it sank, or ships. I'm not sure what the cause was, but nonetheless, to voyage out as we did into this really very remote area of the Atlantic, not often visited, certainly way off of the sea lanes, and to dive in the middle of the ocean and to see these things was really quite remarkable. There's no way that they could have been, no way absolutely that they could have been caused by natural formation of any kind, because we examined the whole area and found it to be really quite like a desert. All you find is, like I said, just white sand. And then to see these great unusual-looking stone columns was really impressive. You got the impression also that because they were tapered at one end, that they were set up in this way. First, a hole was dug very deeply. Then the columns were inserted in the hole with the spike end down, and then fill was put in, and they were probably very stable. The columns themselves would have stood above the ground about 9 feet high, I'm guessing. Underwater measurements are difficult. But the visibility was so clear. You could see everything easily. We took measurements. We lingered there for quite a while. It was really something that I'll never forget. There's no doubt that here we are off the coast of Miami, Florida, and there's remains of a ruined temple that we saw, Moselle Shoals. I've written it up in my books and described it to some extent, and had some of the better photographs in there, so it's, I don't think there's any doubt of that. That certainly is hard evidence. But, you know, the tragedy is, Michael, that you can't get mainstream scientists to look at these things. You know, they just dismiss them. They are of the opinion, ipso facto, that Atlantis didn't exist, and so there you are. Now, if they had found something like this on land, say in Europe somewhere, they'd be very excited about it. But because it's in the Americas and it's underwater, they have no interest in it.
That is a shame, because I think the story you're telling there of your own experience is absolutely wonderful. Now, I'd like to come to, I think, what would be our final subject here, something you've investigated. Who do you think visited the Americas or America before it was historically discovered in 1492?
Everybody. Everybody except Columbus.
All right.
No, the reason I say that is because the oceans were not looked upon as barriers by our ancestors. They were instead regarded as highways. And I believe that many various cultures and peoples came to the Americas for different reasons. True, some of them were windblown. Some of them were castaways who made it here and probably died here. But others came here specifically for things they wanted that they could not get in Europe or the Near East. An example of that are the ancient Egyptians. About 20 years ago, the very first discoveries of cocaine residue was found amongst mummies in ancient Egypt. This was found amongst the mummies that were being prepared at the Cairo Museum by university-trained archaeologists. So this is hardly something involving people that were psychics or trying to channel information. These were college-trained people. And they were astounded to find traces of cocaine in numerous mummies, in dozens and hundreds of them. They also found traces of nicotine. Now, what's interesting about that is cocaine does not grow in the Nile Valley or North Africa. It has never grown there. As a matter of fact, cocaine only grows in certain parts of South America, in Peru and Ecuador. It's not found anywhere else in the world. and to find cocaine and tobacco residue in these mummies that go back thousands of years can only mean that these people that were mummified were in fact users of cocaine, which could have only come from South America. So the Egyptians came to the Americas for cocaine. They did not use it as a recreational drug. They used it for medicinal purposes. The Egyptians were very great physicians, they're very great medical doctors. They probably also used cocaine for altered states of consciousness in their religious rituals. The reason why we say that is because a number of the cocaine users in ancient Egypt were apparently priests or acolytes, persons who were involved, it would appear, in religious ritual. But that's just one example. So here's an example where the Egyptians were not just shipwrecked sailors, that they were deliberate voyagers who crossed the ocean to come for the cocaine. And we even have one of their ships. If you go to the Great Pyramid today, at the base of it, you see the Ship Museum. This is a beautiful vessel that was excavated around 1950, right at a few years after World War II. The ship is over 100 feet long. It's in mint condition. It was because it was disassembled and deliberately buried in its own tomb. It was hermetically sealed for something like 5,000 years. And what the archaeologists did is they painstakingly reassembled it. And when they reassembled it, they learned two shocking pieces of information. One, that the ship was a sophisticated design. It was literally sewn together. The planks were sewn together in such a way that the rope was made to deliberately swell when made wet and created an incredibly tight bind. It also allowed the ship to wriggle through the water in such a way that it was similar to a Viking ship, Labstraked, and that it was designed not for traveling up and down the peaceful Nile River, but for going across the ocean. It's an ocean-going vessel. The other shocking piece of information revealed is that this was not a later design, something that was made at the end of the Egyptian period. This was made right at the very beginning, of the around the first dynasty. We're talking about a ship that is between 3,000 and about 2,800 B.C. So here are people who obviously had the means, they had the technology, they had the ocean-going vessels that could take them from Egypt across the Atlantic Ocean to South America, specifically for the cocaine which is in the mummies. And now, even though all this is known, Michael, this is not any information that I am privy to only, by no means. This is known, accepted information. It has changed no textbooks. We are still told in America that Columbus was the first and only discoverer of America. None of this has changed anything, and yet this is some of the most unequivocal evidence you could possibly hope for, and it is just neglected. It is just ignored.
Well, I think that's sad, but there we are. No doubt in time the truth of these matters, of our real history, will come out. I shall be ending the program now, Frank, and it's been really, really fascinating to listen to these stories. And you're an excellent speaker, and you recall these bits of information very well. So thank you very much for coming onto the program.
It's very kind of you to say so. I've enjoyed my time with you. You're also very knowledgeable in these things, and this is the kind of discussion that I think is valuable, where two people know what they're talking about, and we bring these things out. It's very good. I'm very grateful, and I just would like to mention again, my book is called The Lost Worlds of Ancient America. It's available from Amazon.com if listeners are interested in any further information on what we've been discussing.
Right. I was actually about to ask you to mention that before we close the program. Perhaps you'd also like to give our people your website address.
Well, the best way is probably to contact me through the magazine, which is www.ancientamerican.com. That has a list of some of our books, many of our books, and you can also contact me directly through that.
Right, that's fine. I'll just mention your website again in case some people didn't catch that first time. So it's www.ancientamerican.com.
That's correct.
Fine. That's excellent. I'm sure you must have aching fingers by now to have written over 20 books, and I gather your Lemurian book took you, not 10 years to write it, I guess, but 10 years to accumulate all the information is quite staggering.
It is, but it's so fascinating that you can't let it go. And that book now has been translated into Russian and Chinese and various other languages, and it's really gratifying to see that there are other people out there like myself who are interested and appreciate this great, wonderful story.
Absolutely, yes. And may you do more.
Well, we have another one coming out next spring sometime. So,
oh, do you?
Yes, that one is called Before Atlantis, and that's about the very earliest beginning. Some of the things we've spoken about today, the real early periods like Mount Toba and things like that, the evolution of mankind.
Oh, wonderful. Right, I should think after that one you will have run out of things to write about.
Oh, the world is an endlessly fascinating place.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Frank. It's been wonderful to speak with you.
Well, I'm very grateful for the opportunity, Michael, and I hope to join you someday in England, and I'd love to go back there again someday. I love your country very much.
Thank you. Well, friends, that was I always say this, don't I, after my programs, but that was another very interesting guest. That was surely a lot of information passed between us there. Now, next week, my guest will be Kelly Lashar. She's the author of Liquid Mirror and Surfing the Transformational Waves of 2012. She also refers to it as being supportive tools for your journey home to the fifth dimension. And it includes answers to a lot of questions that I've asked about our ascension in 2012, which, of course, is not far away. We're in 2012 now. So thank you for being with me today. I know you must have enjoyed it. I hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you.